My name is Amanda Lickers. I belong to the Turtle Clan of the Seneca Nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the people of the Great Hill building the Longhouse. My family's from Six Nations, but I grew up just off-res near Thayendanegea, and I currently live in Jochaga, which is Occupied Montreal Haudenosaunee territory.
Could you tell a little bit about your own involvement in terms of the resistance to this pipeline project?
I work against all forms of resource extraction. I'm part of a radical indigenous media collective called Reclaim Turtle Island. ReclaimTurtleIsland.com, where we are at, is Turtle Island, and what we're trying to do is reclaim it. I first started organizing against uranium stuff and then moved into, when the Line 9 pipeline was announced. Myself as a Haudenosaunee woman, I was motivated by the Sewadogosera, which is the dish with one spoon wampum, which we carry between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe nations. And I knew that the pipeline was going to attack our dish, which is Lake Ontario, and that pipeline was approved by the National Energy Board on the same day that the Energy East was filed. So I'm trying to help to elevate the voices of land defenders, of warriors, of grassroots people, whether that is through video or, you know, doing like interviews and stuff, or also just like supporting through organizing. And so that means like, where the CEOs live, where is the headquarters, you know, can we get solidarity actions, can we coordinate ourselves, can we get each other together on the front lines? You know, one thing that I've been proposing is like, sometimes there's a tactic which people would use as like a day of action, you know? And sometimes you'd say, okay, let's do a day of action against Energy East. But instead, I think we should move towards focusing on the corporations. So that way we can do things across borders. The Lakota are also fighting tar sands coming through their territories, and it's Trans-Canada. So if we were to be able to link up and take actions against Trans-Canada, have solidarity actions in places like Calgary, where the headquarters are located, this is the important stuff that needs to happen. We need to be coordinated, because one of our most important tactics is to get them where it hurts in the pocket. If we can cost them financial, they're going to start to listen, you know, because this whole project of resource extraction completely alienates us. It others Mother Earth. It makes us foreign to our mother, you know? Who looks at their mother and says, oh, there's a couple kidneys in there and a heart, you know, maybe if I cut those out, I can, you know what I mean? I can get that money, you know? You shouldn't be looking at things like that. You know, colonization is an intentional project. So things through like the Indian Act and even the nation state of Canada, and a lot of people don't want to hear that, but the nation state of Canada, they're illegally occupying indigenous territory. This is something that's happening all over the world where indigenous people are standing up. Because we have to, because we hear Mother Earth, you know, crying. This is very serious, you know, and I'm 24 years old. I don't want to have kids, and that has everything to do, you know, like, right? And it's like, I want to say I believe in a diversity of tactics, which also means, you know, if people want to do the regulatory processes, if they want to do the litigation, if they want to go through those routes, power to you. But remember, like, what is effective? Because we did all that stuff with Line 9. 5 different band councils, they were interveners against the project, against Enbridge, and the National Energy Board still approved. So many people came out. It was called as an undemocratic process. All these things happened. 2 of those band councils went to litigation, and still the National Energy Board approved the project. Those processes aren't there to facilitate some kind of fair opportunity. They're there to streamline projects for industry. And we need to understand that very, very clearly.
There's a presentation by a Council of Canadians earlier, and it sounded like there was a heck of a lot of infrastructure already in place with pumping stations and the like, a lot of investment and so on. With this much literal investment, are we not talking about essentially consultations as public relations ploy?
I think that's a completely apt observation, you know, and I think that's why we see people like Phil Fontaine, who moved from the Assembly of First Nations to liaison for Trans-Canada. There's financial relationships there. And so I think that's just totally true what you just said. I think that's absolutely correct. It's a facilitation process in order to streamline. They're not interested in consultation. Everyone always says that they've never been consulted. I mean, it's irrelevant to them. It's completely irrelevant. The due process that they talk about, the court system, it's irrelevant throughout history, you know, the basis of Canada, even as an entity, is built on bulldozing Indigenous people. They have never respected a single treaty. It's outlining Canada's own constitution that they're supposed to do consultation. It never happens. They haven't even signed on to the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights for Indigenous Peoples. They haven't done any of this work, and that's because their interest is to disregard. What is happening is a genocide. You know, we're talking about slow industrial genocide. It's not that slow anymore. It's still industrial genocide, you know, and that's an intentional project. And that's what we have to remember, is that this is not about meaningful consultation. This is not about having consent. This is about industry. This is about tar sands expansion. You know, this is about continuing death of indigenous peoples so that way we can be erased and forgotten and they can continue to do with Mother Earth as they please. Which is why I think it's really important for us to remember as indigenous people, you know, as Ongwehongwe, as Anishinaabe, that these projects already target our communities. They target our water. They target our people. They give us rare cancers. They destroy our air. They attack our sovereignty. They violate our own covenants with creation. We're going to die. They're already killing us. Why are we not standing up? Why are we not taking more affirmative action? You know, and it's frightening and it's scary, but we need to get organized. We need to bring back our warrior societies. We need to respect our women. It is a symptom of the way that Canada operates as a colonial entity that disregards not only Indigenous women, because we carry life, right? We carry life in water, you know, and those are part of our sacred responsibilities. The way that Mother Earth is being treated is a reflection, is a mirror of how Indigenous women are being treated, that our bodies are terra nullis for conquest.
Yeah, you spoke about the defiling of Mother Earth, you know, speaking in such intimate familial terms about mm-hmm. the land and the water. And I'm kind of curious to know the extent to which who may not be indigenous, who stand in solidarity because they're concerned about climate change and you know, have a sort of a general sense of fairness, you know, we shouldn't be polluting water and so on, but they don't really have that same intimate connection. It's more abstract.
I want to just speak about what it means to be indigenous for a hot minute. So I just want to also acknowledge like that, you know, some people who live here as settlers are also indigenous people, you know, so like some of our brothers and sisters who have migrated from Abya Yala, so-called South America, a lot of them are indigenous people, you know, who have been displaced because of colonialism, capitalism, genocide, you know, a lot of the time it's Canadian mining corporations, right? So our struggles are tied, you know, so I just want to acknowledge that also, that there's other indigenous people who are maybe not specifically of these particular lands, you know, and also that, you know, settlers of color, folks who aren't indigenous, but are, you know, who come from like diasporic racialized communities, they also live on the fence line with the refineries. We're connected in a really deep and inherent struggle right there. So in terms of people feeling an abstractness, I think that that's what colonization does to us. And in terms of white settlers, you know, I think that sometimes it's very problematic. Sometimes people are less problematic. but I think that there's always a place for people. My friend in Lakota Territory, she says, there's always a place for people from the front line to the chow line. And there's always a way to support. Over time, we'll be able to remember that relationship that we carry. Because I think, this is getting kind of intimate, but like Ongwehongwe, it means human being in Haudenosaunee terms. Right. So, and like Anishinaabe too, right? So it's just like, as indigenous people, we remember what it means to be human. The construction of whiteness in, you know, how we know white destroys ethnicity, destroys like all of those ethnic backgrounds and assimilates. It allows people to forget what it means to be human. And so they forget that Mother Earth is our mother. And they start thinking in this linear colonial capitalist way where they're looking for money. I think a lot of people, just whether you're indigenous or non-indigenous, they see that there's a problem. I think that it's a personal journey for folks. I think it's important to be aware of the fact that if you're not on your own territories, and, you know, cultural appropriation, all these types of things, you know, because Canada is also a white supremacist state. You know, like, look at the immigration policies, like, look at the way they've treated Indigenous people over the years, and, like, even Asian folks in the beginning of the railways, you know, people were basically just, like, put in very dangerous circumstances with dynamite blowing, you know, and, like, a lot of people, you know, if you were not considered white, then your life was expendable, you know? So we need to also remember that white supremacy is also part of colonization. And so we need to be really accountable to that from all of our communities.
I've noticed that a lot of these resource-intensive industries spend a lot of time and money trying to, you know, basically get into these, co-opt them, if you will. So there was, like, for example, the University of Winnipeg, Enbridge was a major sponsor of a science program for inner city kids. It seems as if anything Indigenous related, there's, you know, including a major festival called the Manitou Abe, one of the major sponsors they have are these energy companies. And so, and at the same time, they're you know, trying to co-opt in all kinds of ways. You know, there's carrot, hey, we'll create jobs. How much of a challenge is it to keep Indigenous peoples united in the face of these sorts of strategies?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. It's a hard question. You know, because of the impact of contact and invasion, there's a lot of issues in our communities, and people are often struggling for, you know, sustenance-based survival. You know, like, we don't have clean water. We often, you know, we have a lot of issues in our communities around, like, alcoholism, around abuse, you know, around a lot of these things, poverty, this kind of stuff that impacts us. And so it, when you have kids to feed and stuff, you know, it seems really attractive to be able to have that kind of financial stability and feel that security, right? But we need to remember, like, what the real cost is. And I think that that's the most important piece, and it's hard sometimes. You know, you have folks who are completely corrupted. You know, like, Phil Fontaine is someone who is completely corrupted. You know, he's selling out his own people, his own ancestry, you know. And so I think it's really important for folks to have some of that, like, we need to organize in our communities, whether you're urban or on the res. You know, we need to try to connect with each other and help, you know, even just having potlucks and just talking about our teachings, things like this, just to have that sense of community, so we feel like a bit of a support network, so that way we can do the work that we are supposed to do as protectors, you know. So I think it's really hard. There is a lot of conflict, there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of really particular things that happen that make it really difficult to come together in unity sometimes. But this is a time of the seventh fire, you know, and we need to remember why we are here. It doesn't matter how many dollars in your bank account. If you don't have safe water to drink, your family won't survive. I think that that's the message we need to carry in our hearts and really take that seriously.
I'm wondering if there is a specific experience, maybe in your territory, that really set that fire under your rear end, so to speak, and got you motivated. Is there anything that you could share from your own personal background?
I don't know. It's hard to say, because I've been influenced by a lot of people I've met along the way. There's been a lot of land defenders before me. And my father, you know, has really impacted me growing up, and my mom too. And also, like, my ancestors whispering in my ear when I go to sleep, you know. So good friends and peers. Something that I just, like, had this incredible sense of urgency. I just really realized what was happening when I looked into it. And I saw what that does, what these things do to water, what uranium contamination does, what bitumen spills do. When I learned about that, and I just felt, oh, there's not enough people, you know, even though I know we're out there, but just like, holy, we need to take that up, because I can't tell other people anything until I start, you know. And I think it's really important to start with ourselves and try to move forward in that good way of acknowledging the struggle. It's just like, I'm just trying too. Like, I don't even know. I'm still learning, and we're all coming together trying to figure this out, because it's so big and there's so many years. There's a legacy of this, right? You're not going to just overnight revolution, wham, bam, free Turtle Island. It takes a lot. It's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of community building. It's going to take a lot of frontline resistance, you know, because that's the other thing. People always think, oh, you're always just against this, against that, against this, against that. It's like, no, I'm for life. You know, I'm for the affirmation of life and the continuation of life. And if we're going to do that, then we need to, like, heal. First of all, we need to heal as Indigenous people and as all people who have been impacted by colonization. But we need to protect what we've got, because we can't afford to lose anything else.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that our listeners need to understand before?
A couple things, I guess. One thing is, it's really important for us to try to think about where our feelings are coming from. When we hear things, sometimes a lot of the words that I just shared might upset people. They might feel defensive, you know, and I just want folks to know I'm not attacking them. And it's just, I'm just trying to share a message, because we all need to work together in this way, because we don't have time. You know, that's the other thing, is a really urgent message. And so it's important for us, you know. I've been trying to internalize a lot, like, people talk a lot about being warriors and stuff, but I've met some warriors, and it's a lot more than just putting on a mask and, like, looking badass, you know. It's a lot of humility, it's a lot of respect, it's a lot of self-reflection, it's respecting women, elders, children, you know, respecting the water. These are the things that we need to do. We need to give our acknowledgments, you know, and if we're not doing that, then we're going to be more disconnected. And I think a lot of us feel that disconnection. We need to bring each other together. Another thing I want to say is, get organized, but also, you know, We need to also get educated in terms of things like, how does the state monitor us? How is the state surveillance impacting us? There are things like undercovers and infiltrators, but also like, how do we organize? You know, what does organizing look like? What does that mean in our communities? How do we get people together, you know, and trying to actually try to take that stuff seriously too. And doing our research, you know, we need to know exactly where the routes are. You know, we need to know where the corporate offices are. We need to know who the CEOs are. We need to have this information if we're going to be effective. You know, even though sometimes our hearts might pull us in a direction or another direction, it's important to try to think strategically if our goal is to shut down the tar sands.
Well, Amanda, thank you very much for sharing with us.